Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Thomas Donnelly, counsel to the Constitutional Accountability Center, about a couple of very important cases coming up before the Supreme Court. They will determine how far the EPA can go in regulating greenhouse gas emissions. And I wanted to be sure they're on listeners' radars. Then we'll be joined by Li Fang from The Nation to talk about the shadow lobby, the huge growth in unregistered lobbying. Finally, we'll speak with Dana Liebelson from Mother Jones about these anti-gay Jim Crow laws that are suddenly springing up across the country. First, a few items you may have missed. An enterprising young girl may be the smartest entrepreneur in America. She decided that the ideal spot to set up and sell her Girl Scout cookies was right outside a California medical marijuana dispensary. And what makes this story interesting is that there was a fake photo, a Photoshop job of three Girl Scouts selling thin mints outside a Colorado pot shop that made the rounds on the internet. It was one of those viral sensations. It wasn't real. So this bright girl offered an example of life imitating art. According to Slate, she sold 117 boxes of cookies in just 2 hours. Dr. Roy W. Spencer is a climate change denier. But he's not happy with that term. No siree, he's not happy at all. He wrote this week, and I quote, "When politicians and scientists started calling people like me deniers, they crossed the line. They indirectly equate the skeptic's view that global warming is not necessarily all man-made nor a serious problem with the denial that the Nazis' extermination of millions of Jews ever happened. Too many of us for too long have ignored the repulsive extremist nature of the comparison. It's time to push back. I'm now going to start calling these people global warming Nazis." Now, I would say that climate change deniers are significantly worse than Holocaust deniers for one very simple reason. We can't go back and undo the Holocaust. It's done. It's in the past. But we must fight climate change now, and we must fight it going forward, or we're going to face catastrophe. So which one of these kooks causes more harm? Homophobia is lethal, according to a pair of studies released this week. One found that gays and lesbians facing stigma were more likely to die younger. That's fairly intuitive. But the second study found that straight people who hold homophobic views are also at a greater risk for early mortality. They have an average life expectancy that is 2.5 years shorter than more tolerant people. The same is true of whites who have high levels of racial grievance. But the researchers found that homophobia was a bigger risk factor than racial bias. Researchers think that it may be a result of stress. If you hate and fear gay people, it's stressful to be around them. It's stressful to see them depicted in positive light on television and movies. I have a theory of my own. I think it's from the stress of suppressing their own homosexual impulses their whole lives. Or, hey, maybe it's just that they eat too much Chick-fil-A. All right, what else? Okay, do you remember William Boykin? He was an undersecretary of state under Bush. He reportedly was responsible for bringing the Guantanamo Bay method to the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. He also got into some hot water for making a speech in which he claimed that the U.S. would win the war on terror because Jesus can whoop Allah's butt. Jesus was more powerful. He's now with the Family Research Council, and he said this week that when Jesus returns, he'll be packing an AR-15. No, he really said that. Boykin cited Revelations 19, which refers to Jesus returning to earth as a warrior with a, quote, sharp sword. Boykin told a group of conservatives in Texas, where else, and I quote, "I've checked this out. I believe that sword he'll be carrying when he comes back is an AR-15. The sword today is an AR-15. If you don't have one, go get one. You're supposed to have one. It's biblical." Now, I don't know where he checked this out, and I also wonder if other firearms manufacturers are a little unhappy about that. Anyway, that happened. Disgraced former Speaker Tom DeLay got into this act also this week, telling a right-wing radio talk radio host that our biggest problem is that, and I quote, "We've stopped realizing that God created this nation, that he wrote the Constitution." God wrote the Constitution. Or God may have been the ghostwriter of the Constitution. It's unclear. When I heard that, I just thought about the Three-Fifths Compromise, which said that slaves would be counted as three-fifths of a person for the purpose of the census. That was in the original Constitution. And I just think God must be a total jerk to write that, right? right? Future former disgraced speaker John Boehner said this, that he'd rather kill himself than raise the minimum wage. This week, Boehner spent $800,000 on a Florida resort condo. But not everyone agrees. A spokesman for Walmart said this week that the retailing giant is considering throwing its support, its significant clout, behind a federal minimum wage hike. See, Walmart doesn't just employ low-wage workers. They also make up a good chunk of its customer base. Walmart had a gloomy forecast this week. They blamed, among other things, cuts to the food stamp program and last year's hike in the payroll tax. Their customers are tapped out. Walmart gets over half of its sales from groceries, by the way. 95% of the income gains in this recovery, which is now going into its fifth year, have gone to the top 1% of households. But by and large, those aren't Walmart shoppers. The top 1% are not Walmart shoppers. And the New York Times reported earlier this month that high-end retailers are doing great. You know, Maseratis, they're selling. But businesses that cater to working people are experiencing very tough times. So while Walmart has arguably done more than any other institution to keep American wages low, you know, with its very innovative union busting techniques and the so-called Walmart effect across its entire supply chain, they may be seeing now that that is coming back to bite them on the posterior. Anyway, let's move on with the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Thomas Donnelly.
Again. they're heroes, 'cause they get to feel no pain. I said fools in love are zeros. I should know, because this fool's in love again.
Welcome back to the show. I'm happy to introduce my next guest. Tom Donnelly is the message director and counsel to the Constitution Accountability Center. Tom wrote a piece this week titled Six Reasons Why the Greenhouse Gas Cases Are Worth Watching, and listeners can find it at theusconstitution.org, all one word. Tom Donnelly, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there are two big cases being decided by the Supreme Court. These will ultimately decide whether the Environmental Protection Agency can even attempt to tackle climate change in a really meaningful way. Let's begin with the basics. Can you give us a little bit of the background on these cases, kind of in as simple terms as possible?
Absolutely. So the case is being argued Monday, called Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. And it's a follow-up case to one of the landmarks of the last decade in the Roberts Court called Massachusetts versus EPA. And what that effectively did was it green-lighted EPA's efforts to regulate climate change. It said that under the Clean Air Act, greenhouse gases are covered, and that EPA must go forward, figure out whether or not there's a genuine threat there, and if there is, must address it by valid regulations. And so this case now is a follow-on to that, whether or not EPA can now extend regulations to what are called stationary sources. These are power plants, et cetera, sort of large emitters of greenhouse gas emissions. And industry challengers and some states like the state of Texas have come into court and said, you know, EPA, no, you cannot do this. You're overstepping your bounds. And EPA is coming back and saying, well, the court said, you know, 7 years ago in a very important decision that we have authority to address greenhouse gases and the threat of climate change. And so we're doing it here, and we're doing it in a way that is consistent with the last five presidential administrations in terms of how they've interpreted this important provision of the Clean Air Act.
Now, reading your piece, it seemed like this had been somewhat settled law. Were you surprised that the Supreme Court took these challenges up?
Well, I mean, I think just backing up slightly, one of the most important things about this case is what the court decided not to take. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, other industry groups, states with conservative AGs would come to court and try to really stifle anything EPA wants to do to address climate change. That doesn't surprise me. And in the petitions to the court here, they took a very aggressive stance, asking the court to reconsider Massachusetts versus EPA, that really important case I just talked about, challenging other greenhouse gas regulations, and then challenging this other move that EPA made to address stationary sources. And the court effectively threw out the petitions as to those broader questions and really fixed on this particular program. So at least at a core level, the decision by this court to not grant those other petitions confirms the Obama administration and future administration's power to deal with climate change under the Clean Air Act. And so, you know, in an important sense, that law really is settled and there's no going back. So here, you know, they are challenging an important program, but really if the court sticks to the question that it actually granted, the issues it actually granted in this case, even if EPA loses, the EPA will still have other tools to address climate change. And so there's a sense in which the question here is still very important, but it's nowhere near as important as it could have been if the court granted the really aggressive challenges of the industry groups.
Now, does the way that courts deal with evidentiary procedures, does that preclude having any arguments over the science of climate change?
Well, I mean, interestingly, again, in the initial petitions for review, some of the groups did. What EPA did after Massachusetts versus EPA was go and review the science, and it determined that greenhouse gas emissions do endanger the public health of Americans. That was through an extensive regulatory process where there were thousands upon thousands of comments, et cetera, et cetera, and they reviewed all the evidence and said, yeah, there's a threat. Now we have to address it. And so the industry groups here did ask the court to review that determination, but the court decided not to review that particular question. And so, you know, whereas the court certainly could have done that, it chose not to. And so, you know, if the court sticks to the issues it actually granted, we will not be jostling over those sorts of questions on Monday.
And of course, if the court sticks to these issues is a big if with this court. In the piece, you write that Washington's highly polarized environment is also is one of the reasons that this question has ended up before the court. Can you explain that for listeners a little bit?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it used to be the case. So the Clean Air Act, it's a decades-old law. It used to be the case that bipartisan majorities would come together every few years and amend the act in important ways. But frankly, because of polarization in Congress, gridlock, et cetera, the Clean Air Act has not been amended since 1990. And so what ends up happening is you have a very broadly worded statute that gives EPA a great deal of authority. It was actually constructed in that way to ensure that EPA can continue acting even if there is congressional gridlock. So in other words, if there's a new environmental threat, science confirms it, EPA can go out and address it without further congressional action. But what ends up happening is, you know, over time, as we do not update these laws, the president will continue to act under that old authority to address new problems, and that opens up at least an opportunity for conservative groups, industry groups, in the case of climate change, to come in and say, no, the president is addressing a problem that Congress didn't think about in 1990. No matter what the text of the statute says, Congress didn't really intend that. And so you end up having ongoing litigation addressing what the administration is doing. And ultimately what ends up happening is this ends up before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court as it exists now, the Roberts Court, is a very conservative extreme Supreme Court. And so in the end, they really end up getting to decide these questions. Theoretically, Congress, in issues like this that aren't constitutional but deal with the reading of a law, a reading of a statute, Congress could step in and correct the Supreme Court's reading, but again, because of hyperpolarization, the likelihood of Congress actually doing that is minuscule, and that's maybe even an exaggeration.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking to Tom Donnelly from the Constitution Accountability Center. Now, Barack Obama is on pace to issue the fewest executive orders since Grover Cleveland in the late 1800s. That hasn't prevented conservatives from adopting this narrative that he's some kind of tyrant operating above the law, issuing, you know, executive orders left and right. How is that playing into these cases?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the case that both the industry challengers and then a lot of the groups filing friend of the court briefs on their behalf. So, important people like Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, they filed amicus briefs in this case in support of the industry groups. And they're making exactly that claim, which is that EPA here is exceeding its authority and essentially rewriting the law. What this ends up ignoring is that, again, Clean Air Act was written quite broadly with the idea that, you know, EPA would be able to address new threats over time without having to go back to Congress. And furthermore, that what the Obama administration is doing here is following a reading of the statute that's over three decades old. It's not as though they just took this statutory provision and, you know, just sort of said, oh, we really want to do something on climate change and we're going to invent a new interpretation to allow us to do that. Instead, what they're doing is following the same interpretations of previous administrations, Republicans and Democrats alike. Instead, this time, it actually leads to actions on climate change. And so there is certainly the attempt from the other side to very much make this sound like it's an absolutely radical, crazy move by the Obama administration. But in fact, it's very much in line with past executive practice.
Now, you mentioned that the Chamber of Commerce is one of a bunch of parties suing the EPA in this case. The Chamber often files amicus briefs, but in this case, it's playing what you call a starring role. Here's something. I'm not even sure why the Chamber itself, as an umbrella business organization, would have standing. I mean, many of its member companies are in, you know, pollutive industries or have greenhouse gas emissions that are being regulated, but the Chamber itself doesn't.
Yes, but I mean, it is not unusual for them to be able to. So, I mean, they do often go into the D.C. Circuit, which is an appeals court that's very important when it comes to environmental regulations, and challenge regulations like this. And in that case, they're doing it on behalf of their own membership. I mean, what ends up being, what ends up making, you know, making this notable is the overall success of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce before the Roberts Court, where it's winning, you know, over 70% of its cases. Since the beginning of October term 2011, it's won about 90% of its cases. And those are cases in which it's filing amicus briefs for the most part. This term, as I say in the piece, they are an actual party challenging the regulations here in the greenhouse gas cases. They also are actually, to my knowledge, the first time ever earlier this term represented one of their member organizations directly before the Supreme Court in a case called Noel Canning, which challenged the president's recess appointments power. So we're seeing the chamber already active being quite active this term.
And you write, the petitioners don't agree on what the statute actually requires or how far the court should go to check the, quote, lawless Obama administration. Can you unpack that for us? I mean, how is it that they can, well, just expand on that if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. So this case consolidates six different challenges. And that's not overly unusual when it comes to regulatory cases like this. But, you know, at the beginning of the briefing in a case like this, there's certainly the opportunity for petitioners to come together around one argument or maybe even two arguments and file a consolidated brief. But instead, with the opening briefs here, we had sort of seven different briefs by the petitioners giving the court really a variety of options how to rule, some quite broad, some narrow. But I mean, in the end, really, all that they could agree upon was that they really didn't like what the EPA did and thought that was wrong, but sort of couldn't quite agree on, oh, well, should the court do a lot, a little, what does the statute actually say? That ends up, they weren't able to come around to that particular position.
So here the court has a Chinese menu of possible resolutions. It's kind of a sign of how far to the right the court has drifted that Anthony Kennedy, who's appointed by Ronald Reagan, is the so-called moderate swing vote. What can we expect from Anthony Kennedy in these cases?
It's always tough to predict. The one thing to understand about his role, in particularly when it comes to climate change, is, you know, when we think of Justice Kennedy, we really think of things like his opinion last term on marriage equality in Windsor, on gay rights in Lawrence v. Texas a few terms ago, and that really his push for equality there when it comes to sexual orientation is an important part of his legacy. But really, if we want to understand the fullness of his legacy, one of the most important things that Justice Kennedy did was join with the four progressive justices in Massachusetts versus EPA 7 years ago and greenlight the EPA's ability to regulate climate change. It was that particular decision in the face of foot-dragging by the Bush administration that really cleared the way for the actions that you see the Obama administration taking on climate change, including their move under the permitting regime in the case that's being challenged on Monday, but also other regulations they're doing under other provisions of the Clean Air Act. So it's certainly the case. All eyes will be on Justice Kennedy, and you know it's certainly the case that he has played a very constructive role when it comes to the authority of EPA to address climate change.
Tom, when can we expect a ruling in these cases?
Well, it'll certainly be before July, but I mean, this would most likely be one, that especially given how late it is in the term, we're not going to see until near the end of the term, so in sort of late June.
Tom Donnelly, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a very quick break and then be right back with Lee Fang from The Nation.
Gimme head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen. Gimme down the there, hair, shoulder length or longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair. Blow it, show it, long as God can grow my hair. Let it fly in the breeze and get caught in the trees. Give a home to the fleas in my hair. A home for fleas, a hive for bees, a nest for birds. Ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Blow it, show it, long as God can grow my hair. I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, matty, oily, greasy, fleecy, shiny, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen, knotted, polka-dotted, twisted, beaded, braided, powdered flour and confetti, bangle, tangled, spangled, and spaghetti. Gaga at the go-go when they sing me in my toga. My toga made of blonde, brilliantine, biblical hair. My hair like Jesus wore it. Hallelujah, I adore it. Hallelujah, Mary loved her son. Why don't my mother?
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm always happy to have Lee Fong on the show. Lee is a reporting fellow with the Nation Institute. You must follow him on Twitter at LHFANG. Lee, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Nice talking to you, Joshua.
Lee, Michael Froman, the U.S. Trade Representative, he had a very rough week. He conducted this off-the-record session to encourage progressives to support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA on steroids, as Lori Wallach calls it. And it was very contentious. The Huffington Post reported that in the end, a bunch of the groups that hadn't really taken a position on TPP came out of the meeting opposed because he was so condescending and mendacious. And then you reported for the Republic Report about how Wall Street has showered many of Obama's trade officials with cash. Tell us a little bit about that.
I actually have to check out that initial story. I haven't read that, but I know he's been on a tour of trying to bring progressives into the fold. He was just at my former employer, the Center for American Progress, giving a speech. My story on Republic Report is about how Froman and another official, Stefan Selig, is not yet confirmed. He's a nominated trade official that would help negotiate the TPP, but how both of these individuals received massive multi-million-dollar bonuses, special bonuses, when they were tapped for their government positions. Now, Froman came into the Obama administration before he was trade rep. He was in the White House, but he was nominated in 2009. But it's interesting that these banks are giving their executives very large bonuses to go into government. Actually, many of these banks, including Citigroup, where Michael Froman is from, actually have provisions in their executive contracts saying that they are entitled to special bonuses if they leave for regulatory or high-level government positions. And this poses a significant conflict of interest because the TPP has many provisions that would affect the big banks. And ethics watchdogs call these bonuses "Remember Me" bonuses, because as they're working to advance these deals, it helps when you've received, in Froman's case, over $4 million, and Stefan Selig's case, over $9 million from Bank of America.
And Dean Baker has said that there are provisions within the TPP, and we should point out that we're only talking about leaked documents because this is all being done behind closed doors, that could unwind some of the already weak Dodd-Frank rules through these tribunals, these investor state tribunals, where you basically have corporate lawyers, trade lawyers, overseeing challenges to various laws that Democratic legislatures passed. Lee, do you have a sense of how common these kinds of bonuses are for Wall Street folks?
I don't have a full view because we only have, you know, pieces of evidence that came out in confirmation hearings. Certain 8K filings for the SEC show certain executive contracts, employment contracts for publicly traded companies. But from the evidence that I've gathered, it's becoming a growing trend in Wall Street and other corporations that are heavily regulated and or should be heavily regulated. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, MF Global before they imploded, all have these special provisions awarding bonuses based on if you leave the firm to take a high-level government or regulatory job. And not only them, Northrop Grumman has a similar provision. And if you look at the boutique and very profitable lobbying firms on K Street, they have a similar dynamic. If you look at the ethics disclosures of some of the major lobbyists who pass through the revolving door back on, into public service, that go and take control of the staff committee, they take high-level staff positions on congressional committees or go into the administration, they file these ethics disclosures, and you see these kind of mysterious bonuses. Not only are these folks making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year, they then get or receive something like equivalent to a year's salary as they leave. Now, maybe this is based on performance, but it certainly raises interesting questions.
It's like grease for the revolving door. It seems like such a naked display of corporatism. And these companies aren't giving away millions of dollars as a token of their appreciation for fine service. They expect a return on that investment. And to the extent that they get, say, lax regulation that allows them to suck money out of the real economy, that ROI must be pretty good. Now, that piece is up at the Republic Report, and it's titled Obama Admins TPP Trade Officials Received Hefty Bonuses from Big Banks. Let's move on to lobbying. Lee's got a terrific piece in the print version of The Nation. It's titled The Shadow Lobbying Complex, and listeners can find it online at thenation.com. Now, set up the story for us, Lee. You were inspired to write it during the shutdown when you went to the Hill to try to interview some Congress critters.
That's right. I've been covering lobbying and influence peddling for a solid 5 years now, but I was in Washington, D.C. last fall, not to write this story, but to write a story about the government shutdown. But as I was standing outside the Capitol on the House side, waiting to interview lawmakers, a crowd kind of gathered around that entrance where lawmakers park their cars and go in and out of the building. And I noticed that all around me was lobbying. Businessmen were assembling and talking about meetings, about legislation they want to push, who they could grab on their way out, and different types of committee hearings that were coming up. And I, you know, being a reporter, I started writing down some of the names of the people who were talking very loudly around me. And I went back to my office and ran some of these names through the lobbying disclosure database. And to my surprise, the vast majority of the folks that were out there were not registered. And some of them were, in one particular case, former Congressman Zach Womp, he was a Republican congressman from Tennessee, he was out there bragging about his job for Palantir. Well, Zach Womp, when he left Congress, promised he would not become a lobbyist. And he said his consulting firm only does business development for firms in Chattanooga and elsewhere in Tennessee. But here he was on Capitol Hill bragging about leading Palantir, this very controversial big data CIA-backed company based in Silicon Valley, leading their operation on Capitol Hill and talking to lawmakers about his new gig.
Now, you write that on paper, the lobbying industry is actually in steep decline on the surface. On what do you base that?
Well, in the last couple of years, the last 4 to 5 years, we've seen a precipitous decline in the number of registered lobbyists. The number, the sheer number, a little over 12,000, is the lowest it's been since 2002. And the overall combined amount spent on lobbying from unions, special interests, corporations, has also been in decline since 2010 at very low levels. It's now around $3.2 billion, something along those lines. But this decline does not really reflect what's going on in D.C. The lobbying industry is not dying. It's simply refusing to comply with the law. And this is for a lot of reasons. There are very few incentives to register. There's very little enforcement if you don't register. And simply put, lobbying has become so sophisticated and so large. When the lobbying laws were written, they didn't really envision all the types of activity that go on in the modern influence economy.
And I just want listeners to appreciate this. The official number of registered federal lobbyists, as Lee says, is around 12,000. But you interviewed an expert who estimates that the real number is closer to 100,000. So 8 people are peddling influence without registering for everyone who actually follows the law and registers. How does this affect what we know about how much is actually spent lobbying Congress, the White House, regulatory agencies? Because as we have all these unregistered lobbyists, there must be a lot of money off the books too.
That's right. You know, the types of lobbying that absolutely don't have to be covered are the outside lobbying. If you're a chemical company, you want to influence a bill. Not only do you hire someone to go and talk to a legislator, but you fly constituents from a district in, you coach them, you bring them in, you fly organizers down to a district, you bring them to a town hall, you air special targeted advertisements telling those constituents to call their congressman and support a certain piece of legislation. You bring on PR people so you can place articles favorable to your side in the local paper and in the Capitol area press. All of these outside lobbying activities don't fall under the law, and they never have to be disclosed. That being said, even the type of traditional influence peddling, going and meeting with a legislator, the law is so vague, many of those folks simply don't disclose. So folks like former Senator Tom Daschle, former Senate Majority Leader, Democrat, he regularly meets with legislators and convenes meetings between legislators and businessmen and informally advises the president on a regular basis. Everyone knows that healthcare companies and energy companies pay him. His last financial disclosure when he was nominated for HHS in 2009 showed he was making $2 million in 2008. God knows how much he's making today. And he simply just doesn't register, even though he's doing a lot of the traditional lobbying that would fall under the law. So there's all types of activity that are not being disclosed, and that falls. That's part of how many experts have said that we have something close to 100,000 folks engaged in lobbying, even though only 12,000 are registered.
Now, you mentioned that the enforcement is lax, but I think you should expand on that a little bit. Who is in charge of making sure that people who are engaged in lobbying follow the law and register as they're supposed to?
This was actually the most surprising and interesting aspect of reporting the story to me, because I didn't know this before investigating at all. The only enforcement of our federal lobbying laws is basically self-reporting. So there are two offices on Capitol Hill, the Secretary of the Senate and the House Clerk, where if you decide that you should register, you go and fill out your paperwork, and you file quarterly statements saying who's paying you and basically to do what. Now, if you fall delinquent in those forms without deregistering, maybe you've passed away or you've simply forgotten, those offices will then forward a notice to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice only has one full-time paralegal then looking through these forms that have been forwarded on, and then they type up a letter and send a notice to you to continue filing your forms, or if you're no longer lobbying, to simply deregister. In terms of enforcement of the law, that is everything. If you don't register in the first place, there is absolutely no one in Washington, D.C. that will go after you. The DOJ has never brought a civil or criminal case for unregistered lobbying.
That's what I was going to say.
I think is kind of the shocker.
I think that was really, really eye-opening. Folks, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Lee Fong about the shadow lobbying complex. He has a terrific piece in The Nation. You write, and I quote, "This explosion in spending on lobbying activities may not be visible in the lobbyist registration system, but it is evident in Washington." Tell us about how this is changing the city itself.
Well, I grew up in Prince George's County, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., so I've actually seen some of these changes firsthand in terms of how quickly the city has grown, the kind of gaudy shows of affluence all over the city now. It's really becoming a very gilded city in terms of if you look at the income levels, if you look at the wealth levels, if you look at the Tesla and Aston Martin dealerships that are popping up everywhere. And if you ask around, a lot of folks are engaged in some aspect of the influence economy, whether it's these pollsters, these special grassroots or public affairs consultants. Many of the folks who are engaged in lobbying are being paid incredibly high paydays. One person I mentioned in the story is Apple, their former worldwide vice president of government affairs. It's a fancy title, but basically she was their head lobbyist. Now, like the theme of the story, she did not register, even though she oversaw the strategy Apple had in combating the inquiries about their alleged tax dodging. Now, she was paid $7.5 million. That's probably in the upper echelons, but there are many people that I found who are getting paid $800,000, $1 million, $3 million, engaged in this influence economy, and none of them registered.
Now, with all this money floating around, how is the lobbying industry itself changing?
It's becoming the lobbying industry is just becoming much more sophisticated. You look at a firm called DDC Advocacy. It's growing by leaps and bounds. Basically, what they do is that they engage with a large company's employees to train them on how to be advocates on behalf of the company. So they're helping firms like Walmart and Halliburton and Koch Industries, and they're going out and teaching each employee and each supervisor how to work with their employees. So when a bill comes up that's very important to this company, that they will then call all their family members, and they will act like kind of precinct captains, like this was some type of election, in organizing their own local community and their own workplace to advocate for their company's behalf. This type of activity may be in very small ways has happened before, but this kind of mass politicization of entire corporations and the lobbyists who are helping create this dynamic is new, and it's a quick growing aspect of the influence economy. Also, digital advertising and digital outreach, creating YouTube videos, creating special attack websites. This is another growing area in the influence industry.
Lee, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully we come back to San Francisco again sometime soon.
I really hope so myself. Folks, you can read Lee's piece at thenation.com. Also, really, you must check out Lee's book. It's called The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and it's a must-read. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Dana Liebelson from Mother Jones.
I was too nervous to really get down.
back to Politics and Reality Radio. My next guest is Dana Liebelson. Dana is a reporter for Mother Jones and a contributor to The Week. Dana, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've never been on the show before, have you?
No, I think this is the first time.
I could have sworn you've done the show, but when I consulted my records, that is, searched my Gmail, it turns out you hadn't. I guess I've just been reading you for a while. Anyway, Dana has a piece up at MotherJones.com titled Inside the Conservative Campaign to Launch Jim Crow-Style Bills Against Gay Americans. The really crazy bill in Kansas got lots of attention. It passed the Kansas House of Representatives with a pretty healthy majority, but was effectively killed in the Senate this week on Thursday. Dana, for those who haven't followed this story, what would this atrocity of a bill have done?
So the Kansas bill was sort of one of the most extreme bills we've seen on this issue. It explicitly allowed discrimination against same-sex couples and said that this would apply to food service, hotel rooms, social services, adoption rights, and even employment. And there wasn't even an exception made for government employees, so government employees could also be allowed to deny same-sex couples in Kansas these rights. So, you know, we saw this Kansas bill, and then I sort of started poking around and realized that there were a lot of other states that were trying to press similar provisions.
Now, just to be clear on this thing, if the wacko down at the DMV thought you were too butch, he could refuse to process your application for a driver's license on religious grounds.
And what would happen is whoever was discriminated against would have no legal grounds to sue them. So, you know, it basically legalizes that discrimination and protects anyone who wants to, you know, make these sort of crazy claims.
And even though this bill didn't pass, I don't know if you caught this, there was a restaurant, a diner down in Kansas that refused service to a regular customer who happened to be gay and then posted in the window a sign that said, "No gay eating."
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why people have been calling these Jim Crow-style bills. They're like something that's come out of, you know, 1955.
It's amazing. Now, over at Slate, Mark Joseph Stern, he wrote a piece called Kansas Anti-Gay Bill May Have Been a Delightfully Ironic Political Ploy. I don't know if you can use the word delightful in any context here, but he had a theory, right? Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, a dedicated culture warrior, is looking surprisingly weak against a Democrat named Paul Davis, who is currently the House Minority Leader. Davis is running a kind of bread and butter economic campaign, and he's trying to stay away from social issues. So Stern thinks Brownback may have orchestrated this push in order to get Davis to vote against it so he could attack Davis as an enemy of religious freedom. The big problem, of course, with Stern's theory, in my view, is your piece, as you mentioned, similar bills are springing up all over the place. So tell us a little bit more about that, the other states that are adopting. They're not exactly like the Kansas one, right?
Well, actually, we've seen bills that are remarkably similar to the Kansas one in South Dakota and Tennessee. And these bills so far, I mean, once people sort of figured out that they explicitly said you can discriminate against same-sex couples, they've sort of gotten a lot of blowback. But the South Dakota bill was just absolutely crazy. I mean, they actually put it in the bill that it's protected speech to tell someone that his or her lifestyle is wrong or a sin, which, you know, the First Amendment, that's sort of already protected speech.
Yes.
And, you know, and it also said that an LGBT person who brought a lawsuit charging discrimination based on sexual orientation could have faced damages of no less than $2,000. So it actually made it so that, you know, if you brought one of these lawsuits because you were discriminated against, you would end up paying tons of money out of pocket.
We're like steps away from where we have trials, where we put women in pools, and if they sink, they're witches. It's just amazing. So these are a response to some civil suits that have social conservatives up in arms. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, so we've seen these bills in South Dakota and Tennessee that explicitly say same-sex couples. But what we've also seen is sort of this new twist on an old bill called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Anyone who supports these bills, advocates for these bills, say, hey, this is nothing new. We have a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We've seen this before. But actually, this is an entirely new kind of bill. And the reason it's new is because it explicitly says in the language, and I have to sort of dig through all these bills to find this out, is that anyone can use religion as a defense in a private lawsuit. And on top of that, it sort of defines this and extends this privilege to companies, so not just individuals. So a company could be like, hey, I don't want to, you know, provide adoption services to a same-sex couple, but you can't sue me because it's my religion. And we've seen bills like that in Arizona, Hawaii, Ohio, Oklahoma, Mississippi. And when I talked to some of, you know, the ACLU and people who've been sort of critical of these bills, they said they were all kind of a direct reaction to this case that happened in New Mexico last year where a photographer refused to photograph a same-sex marriage. And basically, the photographer was sued and lost that case, and the company was found to have discriminated. So I think we've seen these bills sort of as a direct reaction to that case.
And there was another case, I think it was in Washington State, where it was a baker who refused to bake a cake for a same-sex couple's wedding.
Yeah, I mean, these are the cases that sort of religious freedom advocates keep pulling up, but the thing is the language in their bills is so broad. It doesn't just stop someone from baking a cake for a same-sex wedding. It also extends that I don't want to hire you because I think that you might be gay. So very, very broad bills we're seeing here.
And it's amazing that, you know, the country is going one direction. It seems like this is the last gasp of bitter dead enders. You know, we're trying to get ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, passed in Washington, although that's unlikely to happen with this Congress. But that's where the nation is heading. And then you have these kind of red state readouts where they're kind of going the opposite direction. It's really remarkable. Now, just so I'm clear, the existing RFRAs, you mentioned in the piece that there are 20, that they exist in, what, 29 states?
Yeah, either through bills or through sort of court action.
So the difference here is that it extends, just tell me what the difference is between this new crop and the ones that are already on the books.
Sure. It's a little confusing. I mean, that's kind of how they get these bills passed, if no one understands them. But basically, you know, these bills started out as being like, hey, we want to make sure that new laws are not burdening religious exercise. But in the last few years, we've seen these laws sort of become much more broad. So nearly every claim of a religious burden can overturn state law. And I think a good example of that is, for example, someone who goes to church on Saturdays could claim that parking tickets issued for a failure to pay the meter burden stops their ability to attend church, so they should be exempt from such fines. So that's kind of one kind of bill we've seen that makes this much more broad. But on top of that, this year we've seen bills that explicitly say that you can't sort of sue someone for discriminating against you if it's for their religious reasons.
If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Mojo's Dana Liebelson. Reading your piece, I kept thinking that there must be an ALEC-like organization coordinating all of this legislation popping up in different states at the same time. ALEC, of course, for listeners who don't pay that close attention to this stuff, is the organization that writes model laws and then fets state lawmakers to get them to pass it. Now, you didn't find a single entity like that behind all of this.
I think a better description would be that it's kind of a network of conservative groups that have been working together and working together very closely, and that's why we've seen all these bills kind of come up at the same time with very similar language. And sort of the two ones that I found to be very involved with some of this legislation is the American Religious Freedom Program, which is part of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is sort of a neoconservative organization that's founded in 1976. And then we've also seen Citizen Link, which is a branch of folks on the family. They have a bunch of sort of state groups, and those groups have been involved either in pushing the legislation or in some cases they've just outright said they wrote the legislation.
Eric Erickson, the Fox News contributor, whom I have referred to in print as a toxic idiot, he tweeted, and I quote, "All work is ministry. All work is ministry." First of all, does that make any sense to you? Is baking a cake an act of religious faith? And is this the heart of their argument?
You know, I think people who are critical of these bills say, you know, you shouldn't be religion doesn't extend to when you're, you know, renting out hotel rooms or baking cakes. It should be more of a private thing than that. So, you know, it's definitely a very new definition. And, you know, we're seeing this play out not just with same-sex marriage stuff, but also with sort of the Hobby Lobby case and providing contraception. And we're seeing, you know, it's going to be sort of the big fight, I think, for the next couple of years.
I have a piece up at BillMoyers.com called The gradual expansion of corporate civil rights. And I spoke to some legal experts, and the idea behind the Hobby Lobby lawsuit — Hobby Lobby, of course, is a private corporation that is suing to block the Affordable Care Act's mandate that companies that offer health insurance offer a basket of preventive care, including contraceptives. And he said, look, honestly, 10 years ago, nobody would have dreamed of making that claim. It's a real innovation in conservative legal advocacy that they even think that this large corporation has First Amendment rights to basically block a law that deals with healthcare. The LGBT community, of course, has been a persecuted minority in real life. Christians have not. We've seen this remarkable shift in public attitudes towards gays and lesbians because they've successfully made a rights-based argument, right? And rights-based arguments, they do very well in our political culture. And I know that your typical rank-and-file social conservative, I'm sure, believes that this is a legitimate claim to religious freedom, but I can't help wonder if there's a Frank Luntz type in the leadership of the movement who knows that, you know, taking wedding photographs has nothing to do with exercising your religion, but just decided that this was the right rhetorical approach to take.
I'm not sure if there is that one person, but I do think this is definitely sort of a new tactic in declaring that, you know, A, corporations are people, which is what we're seeing in the Arizona bill. It's actually defined person equals corporation. And B, that corporations can hold religious views, which is sort of a very remarkable claim, and that we're seeing applied to a lot of these issues.
Dana Liebelson, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank Tom Donnelly from the Constitution Accountability Center and The Nation's Lee Fong. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. Oh, and you can follow Dana at D. Liebelson. You can read my stuff at BillMoyers.com, and you can send an email complaining about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank you for tuning in, of course. Have a great week.